It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and once again, it's time for my least favorite holiday of the year, New Year's.
4, 3, 2, 1,
I don't understand New Year's Eve. People get together with family and friends, put on party hats, and count down the seconds to what? The end. The only way New Year's celebrations make sense to me is as a form of collective denial. Like, maybe if we just drink enough champagne and make enough noise, we won't notice that another year has just died. And let's be honest, we're not good at endings. We don't end relationships well, or jobs, or even life itself. And you know what? That makes it harder to move on. So, this hour, let's talk about how to end things right. How to bring some grace and attention and purpose to an ending. Starting here.
The universe has good news for the lost, lonely, and heartsick. The Sugars are here, speaking straight into your ears.
I'm Steve Allman.
I'm Cheryl Strayed.
This is Dear Sugars.
Oh, dear song, won't you please?
Every week, Cheryl Strayed and Steve Allman host the wildly popular Dear Sugars podcast. They read listener letters and they give relationship advice. And the number one most common question they get is, how do you end a relationship? Or I guess more importantly, how don't you? Charles Monroe Cain sat down with Steve Allman to talk about breaking up.
I want to start with a really obvious question before we get into any examples, because you've dealt with this a lot with your readers and your listeners. Why do most relationships end?
The great kind of fiction, the happy fiction that we construct around relationships, whether it's a friendship or a romantic relationship, is, of course, that it's going to last forever.
Right,
nobody goes into a relationship thinking this is going to one day end in tears and recrimination and self-loathing and the rest of it. And, you know, I think that's sort of evolutionarily, we construct a story in which every friendship and every romantic relationship is going to last forever, is going to be the fairy tale version of that relationship, when the truth is, if we really kind of force ourselves to be empirical about it, most of those relationships are going to end, not because either party is a fink, but because people change and evolve and the terms of their willingness to be in that relationship changes. And, you know, you still have to, in a sense, that's all the more reason to construct those happy fictions that allow you to believe that it's going to last forever.
Steve, that's not very romantic. I mean, I'm not trying to be a smart aleck. I mean, that's just not romantic. I mean, it's almost like you're ruining it, you know?
It's true. And my wife would say the same thing. And my work wife, Cheryl Strayed, is always saying, you know, Almond, you're being a downer. Don't you believe in love? Go to Europe. Take the trip. You know, throw yourself in front of the great steaming train, you know, of love. Do it, because that's what life is about. And I absolutely agree with that. I just think that you should know that the light at the end of the tunnel is sometimes a train. And that I think in a way it's almost like my version of saying you need to have that discussion about end of life. You need to have that discussion at least in your head.
Wow, you're saying you should have that discussion. Like, I'm doing a living will with my wife right now, and
right.
If I was dating someone, I should have. Yeah, it is awful. I hate it. If you were, should I be having that same discussion? If you're dating someone, saying, "Look, let's be realistic. This might not make it. I love you. This is awesome. I just asked you to move in. That being said, let's have a discussion."
This is probably going to end in flames, and we need to get a prenup, right? No, I know I'm like the least – this is sounding like the most horribly unromantic way.
Yeah, I'm not dating you at all now. There's no way.
Nobody after this is dating me. There's no dating happening in my life. But the truth is that I mean that sort of within ourselves, we have to recognize that happy fiction that it's going to last forever, whether it's a friendship or a lover, has to live alongside the realization that it might not last forever, and maybe it isn't even meant to last forever, and maybe there are things within the relationship that were holding you back or holding your partner back or your friend back, and that it's not a cataclysm when it ends. It is the end of one thing, and it's the beginning of something else. I think we get stuck in this idea that the end of a friendship or the end of a love relationship, a romantic relationship, is a failure.
Right.
And I think so many of our letter writers get hung up on this idea, which is really a narcissistic idea, that we confuse that very natural, necessary process with a kind of moral or a sort of failing within us. And then we beat ourselves up, and that compounds the disappointment of not having that traveling partner.
Often, and I didn't know you guys did this, I was listening to this time and time again, where someone will say, hey, what should I do? Blah, 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 blah. And they end up by saying, you know, confused in Seattle, or what should I do? And often you guys will be like, break up with him, break up with her, leave him.
Yeah.
Tell him and do it. And I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Do you see why I'm surprised by that? Like, normally I think you get advice, people like, well, try to make it work. Maybe you should get counseling. You're like, nope, leave him.
What happens is that there's two letters. There's the letter that the person thinks they're writing, which is, I'm confused, should I be with this person? And then there's an actual objective description of how the relationship makes them feel. And so it's perfectly obvious to us that this person needs to end the relationship, but they just need somebody else to tell them, look, you're telling us you're ready to be done with this relationship.
You have a letter, and a letter that was written to you that you responded to that I found very powerful. And at first, I almost skipped it because it's from a cat lady, right? Could you tell me about the cat lady? She's the crazy and confused cat lady.
Yeah, well, I don't think she was crazy or confused. What she was describing, it's a perfect example of this sort of letter I was mentioning, where she was saying, well, you know, my guy's not perfect, but like the letters always begin with a happy fiction. This is the greatest relationship. I met the love of my life. Yep. And like, we've been super happy for 5 years. And then there's like those three sentences, and the rest of the letter is devoted to how unbelievably unhappy they are, how inconsiderate this person is, how much they feel like their sort of self-esteem is being stepped all over. And this was this kind of letter where this woman was essentially saying, I'm thinking about having kids with this guy. We've been married for a while, but he doesn't want to have anything to do with my cat. He doesn't want to have to clean up the cat out of the, you know, kitty litter. And he's trying to make me feel like I'm going to be a terrible mother because of the way that I take care of my cats. And I'm just sitting there. It's like, that's not a red flag. It's like a red cape, you know, it's like a whole bunch of them being waved. If you think a cat is difficult to negotiate, if you think a litter box is difficult to negotiate, meet a baby, okay?
Right.
If you want to talk about the kind of pressures that are put on a relationship, a romantic relationship, babies, they are little truth bombs that land in people's lives. And I believe that it is unwise to go into, you know, not just a marriage, but to become the parent to a baby with somebody who you can't even successfully be respectful and, you know, mutually take care of a cat.
You know, you say something to her in your letter that I found very powerful that I don't think I'll forget. You say, just golden rule the sucker.
Yeah.
You told her, just golden rule the sucker. What does golden rule the sucker mean?
Well, I mean, look, if your complaint is that your husband is saying that you're going to be a lousy mom and is saying that you don't do a good job taking care of cats and that he doesn't, you know, doesn't want to have to deal with kitty litter because it's your problem and so on and so forth. If that's the way that you would behave towards him, if he was the one who, you know, was more attached to the cats, then okay, like, good luck trying to make a happy relationship together. You're like cats in a bag. But if you can honestly say, I would never treat my husband that way, then there's a real problem there. And you need to tell him, you know, I don't like the terms of this relationship. It's a very simple, quick way of saying, let me just think about how I would behave in this situation. And I want to say by that, what's underneath this anxiety about the kitty litter? Because it's never about the kitty litter.
No, it's not about the kitty litter. Yeah.
It's about what, you know, what's dropped in that kitty litter. It's about people's stuff and their anxieties, their neuroses. My read is always that when people are hostile, especially when men are hostile, it always comes from a place of self-doubt. It always comes from a place of insecurity that is kind of expressing itself as animosity or contempt. And this is a lot of what we're trying to do in the show, is to get underneath the defensive emotions to where people actually live, which is in fear, in disappointment, in guilt, and oftentimes in sorrow. You know, rage is a big kind of flashy cloak, and it's always hiding unhappiness.
Yeah, insecurity.
And insecurity.
You know, it's funny for men, you know, I think a lot about men. I'm a man. I think a lot of issues in the news lately have made me really think about what it means to be a man. And I have a son who's a teenager, and I really want to understand it. And I'm trying really hard. And I realize that the generation above me, my father's generation, they don't have friends. maybe they hang out with their brother-in-law, right?
Yeah.
But they don't really have friends, and they don't have these great intimate other male relationships. And it seems like they put a lot of pressure. I think a lot of men do this, but a lot of pressure on their wives as their only friend,
yeah.
while women have so many healthy relationships. And it seems that we're talking about ending relationships, but in reading all this stuff about you and listening to your show, I was struck that maybe men need more relationships.
Oh, God. Well, I think what men do is kind of find safe terrain. Being a sports fan is safe terrain. That is, it is a kind of companionship, but it doesn't push so hard on the fragile sort of structures of self that I think live inside a lot of men and that cause them, simply because of how we're socialized, to not be very naturally – we're not given cultural permission to deal with our inner lives. Let me just say it
yep.
like that. Men are not given cultural permission to deal with their inner lives and to deal with the stuff that, you know, boys don't cry. It's that simple, and they certainly don't talk about their feelings before, during, or after crying.
You know, after hearing you say all of this, there's something I wrote down a couple quotes from you, or maybe it was Cheryl. It doesn't matter, but – a quote that really struck me, and it was so optimistic and so beautiful, I wanted to end with it, and I wanted you to tell me what you mean by it. And you say, every fear contains a wish. In this context, what yeah. do you mean by that?
Well, we think about, like, I'm so frightened to lose this person. I'm so frightened to lose them to illness, to another lover, to, you know, to us not being able to work things out. We kind of live, oftentimes you'll be in a phase of a relationship, whether it's a friendship or a romantic relationship, where the predominant feeling you have is, I'm so frightened to lose this. I'm so
yeah.
frightened to lose this.
Yeah.
And what I think is that underneath that, that perseveration, you know, that obsession with that idea, that fixation with that bad possibility is actually lurking a wish to be free of it, to be free of the constant fear that the thing that's supposed to make you happy is instead making you frightened. We get caught up in our fear of relationships ending. We get so caught up in the loneliness, the isolation, and so forth. And I think part of what we miss is that when you end something, it's not only sloughing off the things that you loved and that were valuable, it's also releasing the weight of the things that were holding you down and holding you back.
That's Steve Allman talking with Charles Monroe Kane. Steve co-hosts the Dear Sugars podcast along with Cheryl Strayed.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. What the world, what the world.
So, we've ended love. Wasn't so bad, was it?
What the world.
Coming up, ending work, ending art, and also life. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. So it's the end of the year, and that seems like a good time to talk about how to handle all kinds of endings. One of the most stressful has to be quitting or losing a job, which turns out to be a lot more common than it used to be. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the average American worker will change jobs 12 times during her or his career. That's a lot of quitting. Ilana Gershon calls this the quitting economy. She's an anthropologist. She's been studying the contemporary workplace. And she says that if you want to have a successful career in the U.S. today, you have to be a job quitter, which to me sounds horrible. Doesn't quitter imply loser?
I am. It's interesting that you mentioned that because a lot of academics told me not to use the word quitter. But everyone in my fieldwork who I was talking to really had no problems with the fact that I was talking about quitting jobs. And in part, it's because they understand quitting jobs to be quitting for another job. Mm. And so they see jobs as stepping stones in a career in which you're not committed to one company. The way to create a career is to move from job to job at different companies. And so quitting has just become part of what it means to have a career these days.
So if people are choosing jobs now, knowing that they'll quit in a few years, how does that change what people look for in a job?
One of the things that people were telling me is that they wanted a job that came with a good company name so that having worked at that company signaled that they were a good worker. But that also came with some kind of odd conundrums because some of the companies in industry get a reputation from having hired really badly between the years 1996 and 1999 or something.
God, it's like a vintage of wine. It's either a good year or a bad year.
It is. And so it was good to have been hired there before the bad hiring streak. So it's a kind of trying to game it in that way becomes really difficult. And the other thing that they were looking for is they really wanted jobs at companies that could give them the skills to get the next job.
Hmm. Do managers get this? I mean, employees are coming to work with very different expectations, so this must change the role of managers too.
I knew managers would tell me that what they would do when they were handling a new employee is that they would take them out to lunch and sit them down and say, well, you know, I know you're only going to be with us for a couple of years, and it's my role as manager to try to give you the new skills so that you can get the next job that you would really like. And they would explain that they were trying to help people get better so that they can quit. I found this very odd.
So how did we get here? Because this is a long way from the days of the old company men.
So I think what happened is that we had a dramatic change in metaphor, that the metaphor underlying the employment contract has changed. From the 18th century till around 1980s, people had this idea that they owned themselves as though they were property. And in the 1980s, things began to shift so that people began to imagine themselves as though they owned themselves as though they were a business, that they were a bundle of skills, assets, relationships, qualities, and experiences that they had to consciously manage as though they were a business and continually enhance.
Wait, what's the difference between imagining yourself as property versus imagining yourself as a business?
Both are ideas of ownership. But when you imagine yourself as property, you get yourself back at the end of the day. You have a clear boundary between work and life, and you don't have to work on managing it.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, do you come to this situation with any particular value judgments? Like, do you think it's a bad thing that we now live in this quitting economy where employees are constantly moving on to the next job and figuring out how to quit? Or do you think, no, it's actually probably a good thing. It gives the workers more power.
I think the quitting is one of the places in which I'm trying to figure out how workers get power in a system that is not geared towards them. And in this case, the incentives are done in such a way that I don't think companies are benefiting that much from having a quitting economy, right? They're losing people who know how the company runs, and they're losing the possibility of having people in the company with long-term knowledge. They're getting rid of the ways in which sometimes companies need repositories of knowledge.
So how do companies manage to thrive when you've got a workforce of quitters? And how do you keep them invested in their work?
Right. So one of the things that I think people have started to do is say, okay, company loyalty is no longer going to be the emotion that is going to keep people connected to the company. And so instead, what they're emphasizing as an emotional commitment is passion. Probably your listeners are constantly hearing about how you have to find what you're passionate about and do that as a job. And that's a way to get for companies to find workers who are willing to work very long hours. It's a way to get people who are willing to put up with not so wonderful working conditions for the hope of being able to do the job that you love to do, the work that you love to do at some point. But all of this is passion focusing on work and not focusing on being part of a community in a workplace that gives you satisfaction. So you're not supposed to be invested in your coworkers except in as much as they might be able to give you a job in another company when they've quit and gotten hired elsewhere.
This also strikes me as something that works very well for young employees who are maybe building careers. I'm not sure how well it works for people once they get into their, say, mid to late 50s. Because it's pretty hard to find another job if you quit and you're 57.
I think that's right. I actually feel that it's creeping down. What I saw was that people in their late 40s and early 50s were experiencing longer and longer gaps between jobs, and they were often being pushed into doing contract work and consulting. And that was sometimes lucrative for them, but also was really stressful and nerve-wracking because you then had shorter contracts and you didn't know whether you were going to get the next contract. And people found this way of living much more stressful as they got older.
So do you have advice on how to thrive in the quitting economy?
Well, I can tell you what I tell my students. I tell my students a couple of things. I tell them that they have even more incentive to be kind and generous to everyone around them because you don't know in 5 or 10 years whether that person is going to be the person who's going to be deciding on whether you get the next job or not. Mm-hmm. But I also tell people, look, these are not just economic decisions. These are cultural decisions in which we make decisions to commit to a quitting economy in many small ways, and we can choose to do otherwise.
Okay.
And
what do you mean? What's, for example?
We could have managers who don't take people aside and say, look, what I'm most invested in is helping you get the skills in order to go further. They can say instead, what I'm most invested in is making this company the best place for you possible. And what I want you to know is that we cherish people who are repositories of knowledge. There are all these ways in which you can shift. And as far as I can tell, a lot of the age discrimination happens precisely in these small ways.
Oh, yeah. You also wrote a piece recently about the subtle language, subtle words that are clues to age discrimination, energy being one, for instance.
No, there are all these ways in which people are signaling that what they want are the youngest workers possible. Enthusiasm, energy, passion, all these words about vitality are signals that the people I was interviewing who were older were telling me, yeah, we know what they want. That's the hidden wink that they are giving that they aren't going to be interested in us.
And in the meantime, since it is a quitting economy, what's your best advice on how to quit?
Oh, okay. So one of the other problems for trying to quit, which we didn't talk about, is that it's actually hard for people to find time to find the next job. Especially because you're supposed to be so passionate about your current job and devoting so much time to it, that managing having a thriving family and being a passionate worker often doesn't leave you time to find the next job. And that, too, is a real problem.
Ilana Gershon. She's the author of Down and Out in the New Economy, How People Find or Don't Find Work Today. Have you ever gotten to the end of a book or a movie and just hated it? Felt betrayed by the writer?
I just can't believe Nikki's teaching that book to the kids. I mean, it's the whole time. Let me just break it down for you. The whole time you're rooting for this Hemingway guy to survive the war and to be with the woman that he loves, Catherine Barkley.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning, Pat.
And he does. He does. He survives the war after getting blown up. He survives it. And he escapes to Switzerland with Catherine. But now Catherine's pregnant. Isn't that wonderful? She's pregnant. And they escape up into the mountains, and they're going to be happy, and they're going to be drinking wine, and they dance. They both like to dance with each other. There's scenes of them dancing, which was boring, but I liked it because they were happy. You think he ends it there? No. He writes another ending. She dies, Dad. I mean, the world's hard enough as it is, guys. Can't somebody say, hey, let's be positive? Let's have a good ending to the story?
That's Bradley Cooper's character from Silver Linings Playbook expressing the disbelief and anguish a lot of people feel on first reading A Farewell to Arms. Ernest Hemingway's classic ends with the two main characters, Frederick and Catherine, in Switzerland. They've survived the battlefields and the hospitals of World War I, and just when you're ready to turn the page and read the end, Catherine dies, the baby dies, and Frederick is left alone walking back to their hotel in the rain. It's like Hemingway just ripped your heart out and threw it on the floor. Actually, Hemingway himself struggled with that ending. He rewrote it dozens of times. And after he died, his grandson, Sean Hemingway, collected those other endings and published them in a new edition to A Farewell to Arms. So Steve Paulson wondered, how many different versions were there?
My grandfather famously said in an interview in 1958 with George Plimpton for an article in the Paris Review, George Plimpton asked him about how much rewriting he did, and he said, in A Farewell to Arms, I rewrote the ending 39 times. And working as the editor of this new edition of A Farewell to Arms, I found actually 47 individual endings in my grandfather's papers, which are preserved in the Hemingway collection at the John F. Kennedy Library. As part of the National Archives.
I mean, those numbers, whether we're talking about 47 or 39, are astonishing. He would try to create so many different endings. Do we know why?
It is amazing. And I think it's a testament really to my grandfather as a writer and how hard he worked at his craft to achieve perfection. So it's an extreme example. I think he didn't rewrite most of his things that many times by any stretch, but we can actually see, because he preserved those manuscripts, how he went about this process.
Well, and he also wrote later on, I mean, much later after he actually wrote the novel, in his 1948 introduction to A Farewell to Arms, Hemingway said, "The fact that the book was a tragic one did not make me unhappy, since I believed that life was a tragedy and knew it could only have one end."
Yes, that statement sounds almost ironic, given that he rewrote the ending so many times and tried different kinds of endings. It's clear from the manuscripts that he always did know that the ending was going to be a tragic one. What's interesting, I think, in looking at all these endings is to see that, yes, everyone's life ends in death, but how you live your life and how it ends is important.
Now, do you have a favorite among all these different alternative endings?
My favorite, I think, is the so-called live baby ending, because the ending of A Farewell to Arms was partially inspired by the birth of my uncle Patrick, who was born during the time that my grandfather was writing the book. And my grandmother, Pauline Pfeiffer Hemingway, had a very difficult pregnancy with my uncle, which ended in cesarean section. And of course, my uncle lived, but the drama and the difficulty of that pregnancy and how difficult it must have been for my grandfather there with her at the time played into his ideas for the ending of the book.
Could you read that ending for us, this live baby ending?
Sure. I could tell about the boy. He did not seem of any importance then, except as trouble, and God knows that I was better about him. Anyway, he does not belong in this story. He starts a new one. It is not fair to start a new story at the end of an old one, but that is the way it happens. There is no end except death, and birth is the only beginning.
So he seems to be giving us a little bit of hope. Okay, the baby does live, but it's still pretty bleak.
It didn't seem the right way to end the story with a new story, basically.
Yeah. Now, there's an even darker ending, what has been called the Nada ending. Tell me about this one.
Well, that ending is really, it's almost like an existentialist take on life, basically. And I can read it. It's very short.
Yeah, if you could.
That is all there is to the story. Catherine died, and you will die. And I will die, and that is all I can promise you. And it seems to me kind of a cop-out of an ending. What's amazing is that that's almost his philosophical ending, but then he goes into all these other endings, and he really, by the final ending, really achieves an extraordinarily poignant and powerful end.
it's sort of like he was channeling his inner Samuel Beckett there.
Yes.
There's no point to anything. There's another ending. It's been called the funeral ending. Could you read that one?
Sure. After people die, you have to bury them, but you do not have to write about it. You do not have to write about an undertaker, nor all the business of burial. You do not have to write about that day, nor the next night of the day after, and the night after, and the progress from numbness into sorrow, nor all the days after, and all the nights after, for a long time. In writing, you have a certain choice that you do not have in life. You can see him working through, thinking, well, this maybe is a good way to end the book. But then as he writes it, the more he writes it, the more he realizes it's not how he wants to end the book.
Which is so fascinating to actually be able to see all these different versions. I mean, it sort of is like you're being let inside the creative mind of a great writer.
I think it's true that most people have sadly experienced the death of loved ones. And there is all of that horrible reality of the burial and dealing with the remains and everything. But it's not what's important. It's not what you want to focus on.
Now, your grandfather, Ernest Hemingway, also asked his great friend, F. Scott Fitzgerald, to read the book, and Fitzgerald offered his own take on this. And it's worth pointing out they had a very complicated relationship, which probably played into Hemingway's response. But tell me about what Scott Fitzgerald suggested.
Well, Scott Fitzgerald was a great friend of my grandfather and an early mentor of his, and he had sought out his advice when he was writing The Sun Also Rises, his first novel. But he waited until the very end to really consult with him about A Farewell to Arms. And then when he did, Scott wrote him over 10 pages of commentary about the book and suggested a lot of cuts, and and he suggested a different ending. He suggested taking one of the most famous passages about how the world breaks everyone, which Fitzgerald called the most beautiful passage ever written in the English language. And he suggested ending the book with that passage, which comes much earlier in the story. And my grandfather actually took to heart this idea because he respected Fitzgerald's opinion. He did write out an ending using that passage, but he didn't like it and he decided against it.
Why didn't he like it?
He had it much earlier in the book. His handwritten comments on Fitzgerald's notes that are preserved in the Kennedy Library were "kiss my ass," E.H. So basically he decided to follow his gut and his own ideas of how to finish the book.
Well, we should talk about the actual ending, the one that we all do know, the version that was published. And I'm wondering if you could actually read it. And I'm thinking maybe if you could start with the lines, "I waited outside in the hall."
Sure. "I waited outside in the hall. I waited a long time. The nurse came to the door and came over to me. 'I'm afraid Mrs. Henry is very ill,' she said. 'I'm afraid for her.' 'Is she dead?' 'No, but she is unconscious.' It seems she had one hemorrhage after another. They couldn't stop it. I went into the room and stayed with Catherine until she died. She was unconscious all the time, and it did not take her very long to die. Outside the room, in the hall, I spoke to the doctor. 'Is there anything I can do tonight?' 'No, there is nothing to do. Can I take you to your hotel?' 'No, thank you. I'm going to stay here a while.' 'I know there is nothing to say. I cannot tell you.' 'No,' I said, 'there's nothing to say.' 'Good night,' he said. 'I cannot take you to your hotel?' 'No, thank you.' 'It was the only thing to do,' he said. 'The operation proved—' 'I don't want to talk about it,' I said. 'I would like to take you to your hotel.' 'No, thank you.' He went down the hall. I went to the door of the room. 'You can't come in now,' one of the nurses said. 'Yes, I can,' I said. 'You can't come in yet.' 'You get out,' I said. 'The other one, too.' But after I got them out and shut the door and turned off the light, it wasn't any good. It was like saying goodbye to a statue. After a while, I went out and left the hospital and walked back to the hotel in the rain." The end.
And that really is a wonderful ending, isn't it?
To my mind, it is the finest of all the different endings that he worked on. And you can see even in his manuscripts, which are presented in this new edition, how hard he even worked at that last ending, changing the words to give it the most power and really cutting it down. And it's so much stronger, I think, to end the book there, you know, where he's actually in there with her.
That's Sean Hemingway. He's the grandson of Ernest, and he was talking with Steve Paulson. You can read all those other endings in A Farewell to Arms, the Hemingway Library edition. So if you've followed us through the hour so far, you know that we're making the case for the power of a good ending. Whether it's a year, a relationship, a job, or a novel, learning to appreciate and honor the end of something is a pretty important life skill. And the place you're going to need it most is at the end of life. Here's one way to prepare. Build your own coffin. With your dad.
My dad, he was sort of obsessed that it should be built out of lumber that would be resistant to rot. And the more he harped on that, the more I'm like, you know, Dad, I'm not resistant to rot. So there's really no point in that. You know, there's like biological hazards and how big does it have to be? Is there a size limitation? It seems like something that should be full of restrictions.
There is a story behind that, and we'll hear it after this. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. NPRX.
I am Simon Critchley. I teach philosophy at the New School for Social Research in New York, and I'm author of Memory Theatre. And my dangerous idea really concerns time and death. This is a kind of personal confession of a kind. A month ago, my mother died, and we were very close, my mother and I. I was there when she died. And I've been trying to, as many people do when somebody dies, to try and make sense of what happened. And the overwhelming sense that I've had, which I think is very common to a lot of people who are in grief, as we say, is that time grinds to a halt. Time just won't pass. It won't budge. It's as if time is kind of stuck. Time, when someone dies, kind of stops. The only thing that I found that I've been reading a number of things connected with grief and mourning in the last few weeks, but the one thing that really spoke to me is a text by an English poet called Denise Riley, and it's from a book called Time Lived Without Its Flow. And that's really the idea, is that time is lived, but the flow of time has gone. She describes it as wandering around in an empty plain, as if an enormous drained landscape lying behind your eyes had turned itself inside outward. It does not feel inward, but outward. A lot of people talk about living in the present. You know, live in the present, live now, seize hold, carpe diem, seize the day. When someone that you love very much dies, you realize, in a sense, what nonsense that is. To live in the present is really awful. To grieve is to live in the present. And all that one yearns for the future, any kind of future, which is one wants this feeling to end. You know, maybe that's the real nature of time as well. That's the sort of strange thought here, is that perhaps the real apprehension of time is strongly felt in these situations of grief. At which point you're rather happy that it flows and moves, and one yearns for that to recontinue.
That's philosopher Simon Critchley. Endings that we've talked about in this hour are in some ways just practice for the big end. Letting go of life. A couple of years ago, David Giffels took on a kind of unusual woodworking project. He started building his own coffin with his 80-year-old father. And then his mother died. And his best friend got cancer and died. And this slightly morbid woodworking project took on a whole new meaning. David tells the story in a new memoir called Furnishing Eternity, and Charles Monroe Kane wanted to know how this whole coffin-building thing got started in the first place.
I get that in some ways your father's older. You want to spend time with him. He's a wood builder, so you want to do that. But why a casket? Why a coffin? That seems a little deep.
It seems a little deep, but it actually started as a somewhat playful debate with my wife. My wife and I have been married a long time, and she comes from an old Sicilian immigrant mother, very old country, with very old country ideas about what a funeral is and should be, very Catholic, very traditional. And I have always said, especially when I was younger and even more cavalier, when I'm finished, you know, throw me in the woods or throw me into a dumpster, or you can bury me in a cardboard box. I don't want anything. You know, why spend a bunch of money? Anytime I'd say that, she's like, oh, you know, it would only reinforce her. No, you have to be buried in a formal, a very expensive production line, shiny casket. And the more she would say that, of course, the more I would say, no, yeah. I actually want to be eaten by a coyote,
yeah.
You know, like in front of our children. But of course, taken to its logical extreme, one might night my dad and I are having a few beers at this family party, and I'm like, wait a minute, this guy could probably build a pretty cool casket. And I'm like, wait a minute, if he and I did that, I would kind of win this fight because I would take complete control of what I would be buried in, and it would be a much nicer casket than she would have spent $3,000 on. Like in my mind, this was sounding like a great idea. And so once you're a certain kind of dude and you say something out loud, you can't back down
from
it.
Right, no, you got to build the casket now.
And my dad kind of started, you know, all of a sudden he'd start doing sketches and doing a little reading, and he was getting into his 80s, and you're becoming aware of your parents' mortality. And it's like, well, this is also a way that I sort of could get some serious dad time,
right,
in that workshop that I love to be in. So it was starting to be attractive on more and more levels.
So you and your father start building the casket. You're having some dad time. It seems interesting. And also, of course, and I'm sorry to say this, that during your time, your mother passed away. Did you and your father find either together or individually, some solace in building the coffin for yourself?
It's weird. And it was almost like the writing gods said, oh, you want to write about mortality? Here, try this. And so my mom passed away. My mom died in 2012, just as we had kind of begun actually doing this, planning and building this. She died in July. And that summer was sort of chaotic and confusing and numbing and raw. Going over to my dad's to work, you know, it wasn't like we talked about it or anything, but there was just kind of this, I'm in the place that they defined with him, and we're doing something together, and that was as comforting as anything was going to be in a time when nothing really sort of puts things back right. But yeah, it definitely did give us A, something to do, but B, I think a more precious time together.
There's a moment in your book. There are a couple of moments that really choked me up, and they weren't the obvious moments, I think, but they were in my life. They were. And there's a moment where after your mother dies, you need to be measured for your own coffin, right? So your dad lays you down and he gets out the things that you're very practiced about. And he, you know, takes the tape measure and he measures you, and it seems so intimate. Can you tell me about that moment?
It wasn't like, come over today and get measured for your coffin. It was like we got there and we just sort of realized if we're going to buy lumber, we kind of need to know how much. And so he's like, well, lay down. And so, yeah, so I'm laying there and for the first time kind of aware of what we're really getting ourselves into, because everything was abstract and kind of being talked about. But now all of a sudden I'm laying – if you are laying flat on your back with your arms crossed in that fashion, there are only two things that could be happening. You're either defending a penalty kick in a soccer game or you're being laid out in your coffin. And so in that unmistakable pose, I'm laying on the floor and my dad's like – it's like he's measuring – a space to put a piece of furniture along a wall or so. He's just like doing this practical measuring. But yeah, while I'm lying there and he's doing the work and calling out numbers and writing things down, I'm very aware for the first time that this weird thing that we're doing together, you know, what it's really going to be, and just that intimacy of your father measuring you. I don't think he'd measured me since the last time he put a hash mark on the door frame when he was taking my height when I was a kid.
You know, as I read your book and I was reading about your mom, someone has died in my family, my brother recently, and I was thinking a lot about that as I read your book, so it was a little bit harder to read for me. And there's a point. Well, tell us about your friend John, your best friend.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm sorry about your brother.
No, thank you.
And those are moments. I mean, I hadn't had one of those moments yet. You know, I hadn't lost a parent or somebody who was that close to me. And my mom died just as we were starting this thing, and a year and 3 days later, my closest friend in the world, other than my wife, died. So yeah, John and I had been, since we'd gone to high school together, but in college we really sort of bonded over, especially over music and, you know, like finding new underground music and seeing bands and trading fanzines and mixtapes and records and also art. He was an art major and I was a creative writing major, so just those kinds of things. And as earnest young men, he would give me a copy of Allen Ginsberg's Howl for
yes,
my
of
birthday.
Course.
And I would find a collection of Miro or something, like doing those things that really, you know, make you feel like you're becoming somebody. And he was the one person as we got older and, you know, into middle age that still had those interests and those passions and really an important presence in my life for lots of reasons. And we kept each other sort of interesting in certain ways. And so when he died, that was the second of that 1-2 punch that really kind of put everything into like, what is, you know, okay, what is, what is life and what is death? Like those big questions that I thought I was interested in that I could no longer dabble with, you know, they were really real.
You know, when I got your book, I was like, man, this is a metaphor, right? I couldn't get more metaphorical than this, right?
I know.
But your father, early on in the process, just destroys the metaphoric possibilities and rips it to shreds. He just says to you, David, it's just a box. Is it just a box? Is it?
You know, it kind of is when I think about it now. I mean, the process of it allowed me the things I wanted, which was to spend time with my dad and to think about this subject of mortality. But the more I thought that it was going to give me some sort of wisdom, the more that seemed impossible. And so when it got finished, and partly because of my dad's influence, because he was always very practical about it and would sort of almost like make fun of me when I would get philosophical, sort of keep me in check.
Yeah, totally.
And so when we finally brought it home to my house to figure out how to store it, it became a piece of furniture. It really did become just a box.
Where is it? What do you use it for? Is it TV on it? What's on it?
You know, it's big and bulky, and it's undeniably my coffin.
Yeah, it's so, undeniably like, that coffin shape.
Where are you going to put it? So I had been kind of hemming and hawing around Gina because she's like, where are you going to keep this thing? And I'm like, don't worry, I got a plan. And I had no plan at all.
Of course not.
And so we were moving it at one point in the workshop, and we had to stand it on end. And I'm like, oh, if you put shelves in this, it would be a pretty nice-looking bookcase. So I outfitted it with bookshelves that can be removed when it eventually needs to be used for its other purpose.
And so since this time, how's your father? He helped you build it. I mean, how's your father doing?
Yeah, well, he was dealing with cancer when this began, and he's a very vibrant, robust person. But he actually very recently has started to go into decline.
Oh, I'm sorry.
His cancer has been advancing for the past couple of months.
And did he build – has he built his own coffin? What's he going to do for a coffin?
We got done with mine, and I finished the book. And he said, well, we made all the mistakes on yours. Now I'm going to build mine the right way. So he built this much simpler, less Baroque, really cool coffin. It's in the traditional coffin shape with the angled edges. And it's just – it's a beautiful piece of work. And he just finished it. I mean, it's really, really neat. And I know for him, even if he wasn't sick, that at 85 years old, it's going to be much sooner. Like, I'm already comforted by the fact that I know that at the time of his funeral – that we're going to have this really interesting thing to talk about and also this true manifestation of everything that he was good at sitting there instead of just looking at some manufactured, pre-ordered thing that you had to buy to put somebody in the ground in. It's going to be this like almost like his legacy right there.
Well, David, your story and your book, that is a beautiful book and I was really touched by it. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Charles.
David Giffel's memoir is called Furnishing Eternity, A Father, A Son, A Coffin, and A Measure of Life. One of the things David did during that year is compose his own funeral playlist. We're listening to one of those tracks. He's going to be sharing the others along with his own comments with you. Look and listen on our website at ttbook.org. And while you're there, let's keep the list going. Tell us what song you'd like played at your funeral. That everyone you know someday will die. Do you realize? Hey, listening to all the interviews in this hour has made me think about an old ritual, and maybe you'd like to do it with me here at the end of the year. This has to be at night. You're going to need a piece of paper, something to write with, and a fire. It could be a big outdoor bonfire or just a single candle at the kitchen table. So what you do is you take a minute and think of something you're ready to let go of. Something you've been holding on to that's holding you back. You know what it is. Write it down on a scrap of paper. Light it on fire. Let it burn until it's gone. Release it to the air and say goodbye to the old year. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and I want to thank you for sharing this hour and this year of radio with us. Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Mark Rickers, Joe Hartke, Steve Paulson, and I wish you joy in 2018. Goodbye. Do you realize?